accountants. Our number one issue, of course, lies with compliance and enforcement. 45% of our budget is made up of those sorts of activities. With the increase that we continuing increase we see with CPAs, we've had a 20% increase over the last 10 years in the number of CPAs in Oregon. We are constantly trying to stay a step ahead. We have an increasing sophistication in financial transactions and, of course, all the changes in technology. We have to keep working to be more efficient as well as dealing with increasingly complex complaints. I think the Enrons and the WorldCom has heightened the awareness of the public that accountants' roles in business transactions are important and call somewhat into question whether their honesty is there. So we're finding an increase in complaints. We have one investigator. Between that and the complaints we're seeing, our AG fees are going up. It makes our top budgeting concern. We have included in our 2007-09 proposed budget a technical adjustment that makes a more realistic allocation of our expenditures towards the attorney fees. And Ms. Reeves will describe that in further. It's in our package 60. Second key budget driver that we've identified is our peer review oversight program. Now, that's a mouthful. Historically, CPA started peer review programs. They're sponsored by our professional organizations. What they do is they go in and they analyze the quality of the work when you're performing a test, opining on a financial statement. This peer review process was originally designed as a educational process and to allow the CPA in confidence to improve their practices. Because of the Enrons, the WorldComs, and the increased scrutiny of the roles of accountancy in business, there's been a push to make that peer review process more transparent. I'm sure you've all heard of Sarbanes-Oxley and the PCAOB, Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, now does a review of firms doing audits for public companies. And we are just now, state boards of accountancy, are just now getting copies of those reports that are finding exceptions. We have the challenge of then developing processes of dealing with those. Now, we don't have a lot of large accounting firms headquartered in Oregon that would we'd be firm-wide with these PCAOB reports, but we do have branch offices. They do Oregon clients, and we certainly want to assure the public and have a presence in the process of improving the standards of companies doing those large public audits. In addition, in 2006, we implemented a process for the next lower step besides the federal public company oversight, this peer review program. Now, local CPAs, Oregon CPAs, that have continuing problems with their peer review reports or actually negative adverse comments on their peer review reports, we'll have to submit them to the board for review to see if there's an ongoing problem. And we are just now, the renewals were in December, we're just now getting some of those reports, and we're having the challenge of dealing with those reports, finding the staffing to look at them and see if there's a pervasive problem that needs correcting. The kind of corrections we can do is asking for additional education, perhaps getting a special review of their work before they issue it to the public, or even restricting their license to practice. If they really shouldn't be doing a municipal audit, maybe they should move on and stick with the tax work where it isn't quite as critical to the public confidence. I think people, you start thinking accounts, you think taxes, but there's been so many municipalities and charitable organizations that impact the public confidence in the business climate that this is an area that we keep a close eye on. A third key budget issue, which I'm sure you hear over and over again, is information technology. The board's computer equipment is 5 years old. We've already had two units go down. Who knows how many will need to be replaced this biennium. The board staff is completing a project from this last year that consolidates all our enforcement data into one database. Before it was a bunch of Excel spreadsheets. I think that that will help a lot in our enforcement activities, but I suspect that we'll find all new ways that we want to use it. The most requested service from our licensees is the ability to go online and do the licensing process. And so in keeping with that request, we have submitted Policy Package 101, which would initiate the start towards being able to offer that to our licensees. I think that will go a long way to maximizing the utilization of our staff.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Are you going to just get off-the-shelf software to do that, or are you going to do a one-off program?
Ms. Reeves.
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, thank you. We are not certain just yet what we'll do. We would like to use our current database because it is already customized for our enforcement data and is upgraded to the highest edition that's available, so it's ready to be customized to allow online licensing as well, and we're hopeful that that's what we'll be able to do. In that way, we would avoid the concern or risk to our data when you're converting to a new database, the training that staff would be required to understand a new database. So we're looking, or we're hoping that we're going to be able to customize our own rather than use an off-the-shelf software product.
Follow
up. What assistance are you going to look for to do this? Perhaps you've got the depth of bench to do this kind of IT. It hasn't been my experience in four sessions in this building that we do information technology very well. Tell me what your plan is to do this.
Our plan is to continue discussions with other agencies who have already initiated the process, find out what software they've used and what success they've had. We will also be working with IRMD for assistance. I would like to issue an RFQ or an RFP to determine what proposals might be available. We have had the database that we use is called FileMaker, and it is one that is particularly suited for non-technical people to be able to work with, and we have always been able to work with it and bring in our consultants only for extraordinary modifications and applications. We would like to continue to have a program that works through that database because then we do have some control and some ability to make changes and work with it. You're correct. We do not have the depth. This is a 7 FTE agency, and even if we could find someone interested, we wouldn't be able to afford anyone with IT experience. So we need to rely on outside consultants or IRMD.
Another area that we're looking at in the information technology, though this will not other than staff time, I don't think direct our cost as much in the way of development, is that on a national, they're trying to develop a national enforcement database so that we can contact other states and determine if a CPA has had a problem in another state. And that's a challenge with Oregon's privacy rules regarding social securities and things like that, but it's an area we're working towards. The last key issue that we've identified.
I'm sorry to be a pain, but I'd like to know more about that. I mean, I think that we can't find out from the airlines what their accident data looks like. We can't find out about doctors moving from one place to another that are bad eggs for one reason or another. We can't find out. At what point does consumer protection override all of these impediments? Are you working actively with the delegation to bring your concerns forward? Tell me what you're doing, because I think that poor old consumer would love to be able to go to various databases and find out that the professionals that they're seeking out to pay to assist them aren't fleeing some other jurisdiction with an absolutely atrocious record.
Yes, thank you. The National Association of State Boards of Accountancy has started a national licensee database, and they have probably 6-8 states already online, so they're in a testing phase, going through and getting the bugs out. I think the way it will work is we will be able to enjoy the fruits of the labor of the other states. The problem is getting our own licensees on there. So over the next 3-4 years, most of the states should already be on this licensee database. Now, most of that is geared towards our state being able to look and see if our licensees, it isn't going to be available to the public per se, other than asking us. And certainly it will help us in determining if a local CPA has problems other places.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
I don't understand if other states are coming up on a database. Are there impediments in Oregon statutes that make this difficult, or are there federal barriers? Because I thought you said there were federal barriers, but if other states are doing it, why can't we?
It's our keeping the Social Security numbers of our citizens private. I don't remember what the rule is, but there's something about not being able to use the Social Security number out for purposes. We would have to ask our licensees to voluntarily give us their Social Security number.
How are other states able to do it then?
They have a different law.
Well, then what I'm trying to get back, and perhaps I should be addressing this to Ms. Reeves, is if it's state law that is an impediment, why doesn't the agency come forward to the legislature and ask for some assistance in redoing the statutes that would make it easier for consumers to see whether or not they were hiring somebody with an unblemished record or somebody with a lot of problems?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, thank you. I'm happy to respond as well as I can. The National Association has this project, and as Ms. Klimowitz mentioned, is still in the nascent stages. Oregon's inability to provide Social Security numbers provides some difficulty because John Smith may exist in many states, and the Social Security number is the most reliable identifier to make sure you're talking about one person. Social Security numbers for our agency, and I think most agencies in Oregon, we have to have special authority to, number one, collect them, and it is only for a particular purpose. And we are required to collect them for the purpose of child support enforcement, but that is the only purpose for which it may be used. And so you are correct. It would require some change in state law for us to be able to collect Social Security numbers for any other purpose. And while the board has not done that yet, that is because this database is not yet ready or open for all the states to join.
That's fine. I give.
You give up
yep.
on this? I was hoping you would, but...
Mr. Chair? No, go ahead.
Representative Cromwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sort of in a follow-up to that, and I... from a standpoint of the technology in your database, so if when a person applies for a license or becomes licensed, does your database then create a license number for them?
Yes.
So does your system, if I may, Mr. Chair, does your system then create an identifier number for them? So... why wouldn't
I didn't hear the answer.
She said no.
Okay.
So why wouldn't the license number become an identifier number so that you can keep your two John Smiths separated in terms of what they do and who they work for and that sort of thing and where they're and where they are with regards to their licensing?
Well, it's a state license number. It isn't a national license number. At this point, NASBA is trying to accommodate and come up with a different way of using some combination of name and a few digits of the Social Security number or something that will get around the few states that have these issues. We are not the only state that has this issue. But as Carol pointed out, this is, you know, it's getting close to the point where it's got a critical mass that the states that are other states are joining, and we will be looking at that, not this biennium, but the following biennium. It will be much more ready for us to join in, and all the work will have been done in the states that are having these issues about Social Security numbers. I think at that time, if we still haven't gotten a way around the Social Security number issue, we will, especially with this feedback we're getting today, ensure that that gets to the next go-round in legislation and try to get something that we can connect to that.
Mr. Chair, if I may, and I'm sure Senator Bates will correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I believe that it's CMS, and so your national organization might want to take a lesson here. CMS, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, has created for all health care providers, and it's called an NPI. It's a National Provider Identifier, I think is what it refers to. And the NPI, and they had about a year's period of time where you could sign up for it. It was free. And I believe that it began, and again, Senator Bates can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it began January 1 of 2007. It is now a requirement. If you are a health care provider, you must have an NPI number in order to practice. It is on a national database, but that also can be utilized by the states. You might have your national organization look into that sort of a system and see if that's something that would be helpful. And as Senator Johnson was pointing out, if there's something that you need from us to help you along the way, then let's get the ball rolling on it.
That actually brings to my mind there's a big push for an ability to easily cross state borders to practice, and more from the licensee side than our side. We kind of like having more control, but perhaps as part is talking about substantial equivalency, being able to cross borders, having a national ID number would facilitate that as well. So I take your point well. That gives me an idea to approach a different issue entirely.
Representative Galizia.
Oh, Representative Crummell took care of what I was going to ask about. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
I'd like to follow up on Senator Johnson's question in a little different way, maybe, if I could.
Please, Senator.
Are you aware of other state statutes concerning these issues? I assume you probably are. And if you are, what would you see as the state that has, what you'd say, the best of these statutes as far as preventing difficulty for the public and protection for consumers? What state do you look to say, these are a set of laws that really make sense, really work for everybody involved? Have you looked at other state laws to see what goes on as far as that's concerned? I mean, in medicine, we do that all the time. We look at whether the Board of Medical Examiners or boards are doing and what's happening and what their rates are and all this sort of stuff. Is there a model out there that you would like to say, hey, this state has really got it figured out, and have you thought about bringing that back to us? We don't have to reinvent the wheel here. What are other states doing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, I'll respond. Mm-hmm. I have to tell you that we do not have that sort of information. We know that the states vary, but we do have the ability to do a poll of other states' boards of accountancy, who can tell us about the differences in their rules, and that's an excellent suggestion for trying to determine what state seems to have workable rules. Within this profession, the sunshine laws in the state of Oregon present a problem for other states where they were based on transparency, where everyone's trying to have transparency, but they don't want what is sent to the Board of Accountancy to suddenly become a public document. And so there was a great deal of pushback when we wanted to obtain these peer review reports that Ms. Klimowitz was talking about earlier. If they came into the board office and remained confidential, then we wouldn't have had such a problem in trying to institute that. But because of our sunshine law, other states view us as being a very difficult state to work with. Most states have some level of confidentiality. As to the Social Security numbers, I know that there are a few other states who have to have specific authority to collect them and then may not release them except for identifiable purposes. But there are many states that seem to be fairly open, and I think that's a very good suggestion to look at that and try to determine what sort of provisions make it workable and what sort of provisions provide impediments. And we'd like to look forward to that. Thank you.
Okay. Follow-up. Last question, too. I assume you have a national organization?
Yes, we do.
Some of us do for these sort of things. And maybe you could query them to ask for that information, and they can give you some help doing that.
Thank you.
Claire has a question. You have access to the Justice Department, as most of the other agencies that we see have?
Mr. Chair, in terms of the LEDS criminal background check?
No, I'm not talking about criminal background checks. I'm talking about legal opinions.
Oh, certainly.
Have you approached this whole issue with the Justice Department to find solutions to your problems?
Mr. Chair, we have asked for opinions from the AG's office, not formal opinions, but written opinions from our own legal counsel, as to what use we may make of the Social Security numbers that we collect.
Do you have copies of those opinions?
I do.
Would you please
provide them to the committee? I'd be happy to provide them to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Please.
The last key issue that we're dealing with is the implementation of licensee background checks. We got that authority the last legislative session. We have not started obtaining those as yet. We just started 4 years ago computerized testing on the CPA exam. And until all the bugs were worked out of that, we didn't feel it was expedient to go ahead and finish the process of obtaining the licensee background checks. But that is a focus for the oncoming biennium, and to finish that off. And at this point, I want to hand over to Ms. Reeves and let her take the lead.
Thank you. Any further questions on our big issues and budget drivers?
Just on what you just said, so the focus, so when will you be done? When will you, in terms of the background checks, you said the focus is on the next biennium. I mean, when will you be ready to go so that you will do those background checks that you now have authority to do?
I'll respond.
Thank you, Ms. Reese. She knows more about the administrative timeline.
Mr. Chair, Representative Galizio, in the 05-07 session, the board obtained authority to take fingerprints of licensees. We neglected to include employees in that bill. And so we have joined a bill that's circulating this term to extend our authority to also include employees, because our employees have access to Social Security numbers, credit card information, personally sensitive information that should be equally protected. And so we're hoping that that's going to go through. Nevertheless, that will not impede our timeline to begin working with licensees. That is one of the goals of this biennium in the board's strategic business plan, and we need to develop the policy and to develop administrative rules. We had been waiting in the last 2 years because there were going to be model rules provided by DAS and by the AG's office. And when they came out, they were focused on obtaining employee fingerprints. They weren't focused on licensing. So they need considerable modification, and we have not begun that process yet. I would anticipate that the board will be ready to proceed in probably 2009.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Chair Jensen. Ms. Rivas, actually this says fingerprints to include employees, contractors, and vendors. Could you expand on that a little bit? Who are your contractors and vendors, and what is the purpose of fingerprinting them?
Yes, I can. Chair Jensen, Senator Whitsitt. Contractors, we contract with a computer consultant, and there are probably two individuals who work as contractors for us. They have access to our database. Our database has all the personal information and social security numbers in it. So they have the ability to modify or take away from or alter that database in some way. So we feel that we need to have their fingerprints. Vendors would relate to the employees of our national organization that we've previously mentioned, because they handle the uniform exam. They are a clearinghouse for all applications to take the computerized exam. So they receive personal information about our exam candidates. And so the board feels that they would also want to protect information of exam candidates that, that pass through our hands to this national association. Those are the only contractors and vendors that I would foresee.
Thank you.
Please. Senator Johnson.
What happens if they object? And what's plan B?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, if a contractor objects, I guess they don't need to contract with us. We would find another contractor. The administration, the National Association, if that is your concern, I think they would be willing to have their employees fingerprinted. I don't think they would object, but I don't know that.
Well,
follow up.
Isn't that a fairly easy inquiry? You're attached to a bill right now that would require that, mm-hmm. and you haven't inquired of the National Association. It seems to me that a phone call might avert a confrontation.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, you're right, it would. We've only just, we're not yet attached to the bill. We're only now doing amendments. So that phone call is among the things that we need to do. Thank you. The next area in the information that you have goes to our performance measures.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry to
Representative Crummell,
but I'm confused, and as Senator Johnson would probably agree, that's nothing new, but for me anyway. In your material here under number four, with the implementation of the background checks, it states that the board is required by federal law to maintain Social Security numbers of all its licensees and to maintain that information in a database. And approximately, so there's 9,000 and about 300 new licensees a year. But when we were talking about the information technology, you were talking about not having the authority to collect the Social Security numbers? Or did I misconstrue that?
Chair Jensen, Representative Crummell, no, I probably misspoke. We are required and authorized to collect Social Security numbers for the purpose of the Child Support Enforcement Program. We do not have any authorization to require Social Security numbers for any other reason. And just because we have collected them for this purpose, we can't pull them out and use them for another purpose. They're like over in a locked drawer only for child support enforcement. We would have to have, as Senator Bates pointed out, some authority, whether it be federal or state, to collect them. And the purpose, I believe, would have to be expressly stated.
Okay. Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
On to performance measures. The board has five performance measures. Two of them are the uniform performance measures that you have seen and will see of all agencies, customer satisfaction. And the last one is the best practices for boards and commissions. The three
what are your customers, if I might?
Our customers include, of course, our licensees. We consider our customers also to be those folks who have complaints, the public, who use public accounting services, the professional organizations who have an interest in our regulation for their members, We also work with numerous federal and state agencies who have an interest in the work of public accountancies. Other stakeholders include people who rely on, they may not be the direct consumer of accountancy work, but they rely on the work that a certified public accountant performs. For example, banks, who require their customers to obtain a review or a financial report of some kind on their financial statements in order to make a determination about a bank loan. And so it is a CPA or a certified public accountant or a public accountant who will provide that report for banks or other lenders to use in determining their own business needs. Leasing companies are the same.
Banks are kind of a unique situation, aren't they, that they have a fairly select group of CPAs that do their work, to do those reviews?
I'll take that one. Yes, Chair Jensen. Banks, it is definitely a specialization that do the financial reports for banks. I think what Ms. Reeves was alluding to is, and in fact our public member that we have on our board now is from the banking industry, because they are such a heavy user of the product that the financial statements that CPAs opine on.
So we're referring,
they get it both ways.
So you're referring mostly to banks as a user then of the financial reports, to make it nice and simple for me, that I or somebody else might submit to them for purposes of a business loan or whatever, some a loan of some sort.
Correct.
Okay.
Our second performance measure is the percent of complaints processed in 6 months, and we have had this performance measure for a number of years. I have attached in this little folder that you received a copy of the revised annual report of performance measures, and I think that is at attachment B, and that includes the bar graphs for each performance measure so that you can see at a glance our performance. The time, the six-month period for processing a complaint refers to the time period from receipt of the complaint to the time that we've conducted an investigation and submitted it to the board standing committee for review and recommendation. After the point of committee meetings, we as staff no longer have control over the time frame that it takes to work an investigation or a complaint through to the end, but we do have control over the period of time that an investigation is conducted. And 6 months has been an ambitious goal. Many of our complaints we are not able to investigate and submit to committee within 6 months. For the last 4 or 5 years, we've been pretty steady around the 50% mark in reaching that goal. The board is not satisfied with that, and neither is the board staff. So we are working to improve that.
What are you doing to improve that?
We are using more outside consultants for complex cases. We have also asked both the board and committee staff to committee members, I should say, to have an additional meeting each year, so that they double up the number of complaints that they can process and get through. When those complaints are processed and through, then the staff's focus can be focused on existing complaints. Part of the backlog was caused by various circumstances, changing investigators, training new investigators, complaints that weren't properly registered by an investigator who then left the office, and so then they suddenly had to be all registered, you know, opened in a single year, so that we've had a backlog, and that backlog has been significantly reduced, so we think that we're going to be able to show some progress in this next year and going forward.
Can you tell me a little bit about your investigators? Do you have in-house investigators or contract investigators?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, we have one in-house investigator.
One in-house investigator for the entire
yes, sir.
Industry in the state of Oregon?
Yes, sir.
which might take the person outside of the state of Oregon as far as investigations are concerned. Is that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Do we have a any sort of a proposal, or have we had any sort of a proposal to legislatively address this issue? To authorize somehow or another more investigators?
Mr. Chair, thank you for that suggestion. That is something that has been high on the board's discussion in the last year, but they felt that they'd like to see through this the backlog when we get the backlog close up to see what is really going to be the need. We do think that, there's...
Excuse me, but is that pushing you into a catch-22? You know, where the further, faster you go, the faster the one investigator goes, the further behind he becomes or she becomes?
Chair Jensen, part of the aspect of this is it's difficult to get in any one particular investigator the kind of depth of background you need for the particular complaint. So part of our dealing with this
I was going there with that, too, with the concern as to... you know, it strikes me you're looking at a fairly sophisticated person or persons, you know, to be in these positions. And I was going with the next question of having to do with ability or to retain this or the continuity of this particular program. The compensation that these individuals have, and if you have any ability to enrich that compensation commensurate with the level of the level of skill of the person that you're looking for or need, a person you're looking for or need.
Mr. Chair, you've addressed the problems that we have seen very well. Continuity has been a big problem. Within the job classification, we don't offer the salary that a certified public accountant can earn in the private sector. And so you have to find an individual who's...
You've already got a problem that you can't overcome.
Right. However, the board has talked about the need to get at least a half-time FTE or perhaps a full-time FTE to assist in this role, because you are absolutely right as well. The harder our investigator runs, the farther she's coming behind. And we believe that we are at the point where we may need to add an FTE in that investigator position and give her some relief.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Chair Jensen. Just some basic facts here. I mean, the number of complaints... Are the number of complaints increasing? You said that 50% of the complaints are usually handled within 6 months, but what is the average? I mean, are you out there finding out more than that? And then finally, have you looked into purchasing this investigative capacity from, say, the Secretary of State's Audit Division or from the State Treasurer, as opposed to putting on a, you know, hiring? These people, these other agencies have that expertise. I wonder if you looked into that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitson, no, we have not looked at Secretary of State. We have looked at Department of Justice to do some investigations for us that we felt did not require the technical expertise, and that helped get rid of some of the backlog. I'm trying to think back to your earlier question.
Number of complaints, are they increasing, and what is the average as opposed to the, you said that half are done by 50% within 6 months, but I mean, is the average much longer than that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, the number of complaints in the month of January, we have already received 10 new complaints. So if you extrapolate that by the month, it's going to be about 120. I think our yearly average has been more in the neighborhood of 80 complaints per year that we receive. The average time to complete, to process a complaint, I would say that the 50% that are doing it at 6 months probably represents the average. Outside of that, then you're talking about complaints that are subject to outside investigation, or they are pending because litigation has been filed and the board does not wish to go forward with an investigation in the face of pending litigation.
And then the number. Yes, please. The number of investigations in your backlog.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, we look at that every month, and I believe that the number, we were looking at anything prior to 2006 as being in the backlog, and that were received in the year 2006. And when we looked at it in January, I believe we had cleared all old investigations save one that was filed before 2006.
And how many were filed in 2006?
And the total remaining on our backlog, not that were filed in 2006, the total remaining to be investigated that have a 2006 receipt date are probably 47 or 48.
Okay. Please, appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Performance measures 3 and 4 also relate to our enforcement program, and they are new performance measures and have yet to be tested. Performance measure 3 is one that measures the number of complaints that result in disciplinary action. And this is sort of a upside-down performance measure. One would anticipate a lower number to be a better result. We want fewer complaints to result in disciplinary action. That is, the board does not control the number of consumers who may feel that there has been a problem, but in fact there was no violation of our rules, and so we find no violation there. We don't control reports that are filed with us, but we can control the behavior of our licensees. And so the board looks at this as a two-point attack. First of all, the board's ability to provide deterrence for future violations, and this is done through disciplinary action. Civil penalties certainly are a deterring factor, or if one should lose one's license, that's very much a deterring factor. In addition, the board will impose corrective measures that Ms. Klimowitz has already referred to that speak directly to the sort of conduct that caused the violation. For example, they may require the licensee to obtain additional continuing education. If it is a matter that had to do with peer review or test functions, they may require the licensee to obtain additional peer review or to have their reports reviewed before they're issued to see if there's any problems with them. And then that report comes back to the board. So those are corrective actions that help the licensee change the conduct so that he won't be in violation any further. So those are individual. That's the individual target. The board also feels that they can strike at this through their publication to the entire licensee population. Not only are disciplinary actions published in our newsletter and on the website, as one would expect, but we also include case studies of common violations in the ethics continuing education program that is required for licensees. So when they take their ethics program, they're reviewing the sort of things that could occur in their practice, and so they're learning from that. You also have the fact that no licensee wants his name to appear in the board newsletter or on the board website. So we think that these educational tools, together with the correctional activities that help to deter bad action, may in fact make this a good performance measure. But it's new. We have no data thus far, and so we'll be watching it to see. Performance measure number 4 is also a new one, and this is an efficiency performance measure. It goes to the number of disciplinary actions that can be resolved through a consent order. A consent order is preferable to the board and to the licensee. Administrative hearings, litigation is expensive. It disrupts your normal business practices. It can cost you clients if there's publicity out there. People prefer to resolve things. The board also strongly believes that individuals who are allowed to participate in the final order, in the resolution, are more likely to comply with the resolution. And so if the board is able to come to terms, a settlement agreement that meets both the licensee's needs to correct his actions and the board's needs to protect the public, that it is going to be a more meaningful resolution of the matter. And so we solicit and encourage consent orders from the time that a violation is found. However, There is always the situation where a licensee wishes to request an administrative hearing. They have that right. They have the right to be heard. And very often, you know, they choose to exercise that right. They want their story to be heard, and perhaps in the hope that there really won't be a violation and their name will be clear, that the board is wrong in its determination. So this is one where we hope to see an upswing in the numbers. We hope to see more consent orders. The last one is the other uniform measure that I mentioned to you earlier is the one that boards and commissions are being asked to follow. In the next years, it looks at effective governance by the members of the boards and commissions. The Board of Accountancy will have no difficulties meeting this performance measure. Most of the criteria that is mentioned in the best practices model are criteria that the Board of Accountancy already follows, and so the targets that we have set for the board are at 100%. The next area of discussion in your book is prioritized list of programs and services. This is a difficult area for the Board of Accountancy and other small boards to look at because we don't have multiple programs. We have a single program. It's a regulatory licensing program, and everything we do revolves around that single goal. We are, as you know, other fund revenue. But if we categorize the activities within that program, we would categorize them in licensing, compliance and enforcement, and finally in board support. Licensing we've talked about. However, I will stop anytime you wish. it seems repetitive. The licensing program begins with the exam process. Every person who wishes to be a licensed accountant in Oregon must take the Uniform Certified Public Accountant exam. So it begins with reviewing applications that we receive for eligibility to take the exam. Then it continues to administer the exam applications, approve exam grades, issue those, and then you're on to the licensing process and applications for the license. The same goes for public accounting firms. Yes, sir.
Before they take the exam, are there any qualifications?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair, there are. There are two levels of licensing that the board issues. One is the certified public accountant license, and the other is a public accountant license. The certified public accountant license is the one that is uniform in all states and that every person has heard about a certified public accountant.
Every person what?
Knows that name, knows a certified public accountant and what that person is. To be a certified public accountant, one is required to have 150 hours of higher-level education, and that 150 hours must include a bachelor's degree and 30 hours. The 30-hour hours do not have to be in any particular subject, but it's 30 hours over a bachelor's degree. They also must have 2 years of experience in a public accounting practice of some sort, and they must pass the exam. The exam is composed of four sections. The public accountant license is a little different. One may qualify to be a licensed public accountant with a high school degree. If you are going to go that path, then you must have 2 years of public accounting experience before you take the exam, and you take three sections of the exam only. You do not take the audit section. And you have to have another year of public accounting experience after you take the exam. So the board makes up... Yes, sir?
Take or pass.
How many...
You must pass.
I apologize. You must successfully complete.
Okay.
Yes. Compensate for the lack of education, these licensees are, or these applicants are obtaining additional experience in public accounting. Okay? Now, their license is restricted. Because they don't take the audit section of the exam, they may not perform audits.
May they perform audits under the supervision of a, in an office?
Yes, sir. Okay. At all times. At all times. The board also registers public accounting firms and monitors those. And that's our licensing activities. That, of course, then includes renewals, reinstatements. We also license for substantial equivalency, and we license municipal auditors. At this point in your testimony, I was bringing in discussion of Policy Package 101. I can discuss that now, or I can wait until later. I brought it in here because it has to do with licensing.
Please.
Okay. We have requested a policy package for $50,000. $50,000 is not a number that has any meaningful support. It is an amount that we feel is going to allow us to initiate activities to go forth and determine what sort of system we need, and perhaps to do an RFP and determine a consultant and to establish certain activities that we want done initially. It's entirely possible that the entire project will cost more than $50. I doubt if it will cost less. And when we find out, then we will request additional funds from our cash reserves. The board anticipates that a large number of its licensees will want to participate in online licensing based on comments that we get back from customer surveys and based on the sophistication of the accounting profession. They're used to using the internet and computers for all sorts of services, and they expect it, as most of our population does today. The project will occur in phases, and phase one would include online licensing for substantial equivalency, online licensing for public accounting firms, renewals for public accounting firms. The more difficult aspects, which are renewals of our licensee base, would be put off until we see successful completion of the earlier stages, and that would be done in a later stage. We would expect to achieve various efficiencies through this project. Reduction of data entry by staff. If, in fact, through the process, licensee data entry that's entered by the applicant or by the licensee would be transmitted directly to our database rather than held in a library for transfer, we expect it would be less than the time that's required to process incomplete applications, because we expect a system to shut down or to advise a person that you have not provided all the information that's required and therefore this has not been processed. Currently, those come to us. We send back letters. We ask for whatever they forgot, and there's the time lag involved. And we expect, of course, it would be certain office costs that would be reduced. We've talked a lot about the compliance and enforcement activities. Enforcement, I think probably you understand our process pretty well. Our compliance activities are the two prior basic ones are continuing education, a requirement for most professional licensees, and peer review, which has also been discussed, and that's the way that we watch the review that's done for folks who choose to provide attest services to their clients. And finally, board support would be the third category of activities. And, of course, board support is provided by the staff, and it is universal. It goes through all of the programs. And if there are no questions about that area, the next area goes to our policy option package and our policy package 101. Policy package 060 is simply a technical adjustment since 0305, our AG fees have exceeded the line item allocation. And so we have asked that an amount be transferred from other agency programs to the AG line item. It makes no difference to the bottom line of our expenditures, but it will provide a more accurate allocation of AG fees.
Senator Johnson.
Long term, how do you plan to manage AG fees? Because you can move money around inside your agency only so long if you have a cost center that's rising.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, long term. The board has taken some steps beginning this year to reduce AG fees that are mentioned in here, I believe, by maintaining all of the activities in our board meetings that require AG attendance in a block so that the AG attends them. We also already prepare much of the work that other agencies rely on the AG to do. We prepare all of our own notices, all of our consent orders, all of our default orders. The only ones they prepare are the ones that they work with for administrative hearing, and very often we participate in that preparation also. I don't see that there is much additional that we can do to reduce our AG fees at this time. And so I guess we would have to ask for an increased allocation in another budget session.
An increased allocation, that would have to come in the form of a fee bill, wouldn't it?
I think it would be, yes. It would have to be accompanied by a fee bill.
And
yes.
You're all other funds.
Yes, we are.
So the only other place you can get money is, right now, the way you're structured, is a fee bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair, you're correct.
Further?
No, thank you.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Cromwell.
Is the inflation rate of the increased AG fees, is that what the AG has asked for in their budget, and so you're reflecting that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cromwell, I don't know who determines that inflation rate, whether DOJ requests it or whether DAS dictates. Agencies are provided with the approved inflation rate each biennium, and 14% is the amount that we were provided for the 07-09 biennium. And so I'm sure DOJ has something to say about it because they ask for the fee increase each biennium, so perhaps this reflects their fee increase. But my figures, yes, are based on that inflation rate plus what I believe is our increase in services shown over time.
Mr. Chair, I have a question for LFO on this.
Please.
Why would the executive branch be asking for a 14% inflation rate for a biennium when there's only been, if you compound the two years in a biennium, and based on the Portland CPI, it's been at about 2.9%. So if you compounded that and were somewhat generous, you could say 6.1, 6.2% inflation over the two-year period of the Portland CPI. Why would the executive branch be asking for a 14? That's more than double what the CPI over a biennium or over a two-year period would be. Can you help me understand that one?
Chair Jensen, Representative Crummel. I believe the confusion is in using the term inflation. I don't. The increase in the AG bills is not necessarily linked to inflation as we would define it around the CPI in a metropolitan area. That is the increased cost that the AG has incurred, and those are negotiations. The rate that they are able to charge agencies is a negotiation that goes on with the executive department. So I think usually using the term the inflation rate of 14% for AG bills, I think, is misleading. So it's not necessarily linked to an economic indicator of any kind other than the cost that the AG has or DOJ has incurred for these services.
Am I correct in that that could be a demand, could be influenced by simple increase in the demand for service?
Chair Jensen, I don't know that it's necessarily a demand function as much as it's a function of what it costs for them to bring in legal counsel to help the agencies with their issues that require the legal counsel. So I think it has more to do with their internal costs are to provide the service.
What I find interesting, Mr. Chair, is that the AG's office also has a very captive audience. or a captive clientele is, would be a more way, more appropriate way of putting it, because an agency can't go outside for legal services, and especially some of the mundane stuff that they might have to do, contract, you know, contract oversight, stuff like that. They have to go to the AG's office. They have no choice. And I find it kind of alarming that the AG's office can turn around and say, well, you know, and it almost sounds like a PFA, pluck from air amount. You know, well, we'll just charge 14% over the next biennium, and that's how much we want to increase things by. I just have a real problem with that.
I think probably a legitimate problem. I think also the amount of the AG's request is also subject to the overview of the Ways and Means process. Am I mistaken on that?
Sure, Gaines, I believe you're correct.
Yeah. Well, not necessarily do they get that request. I don't know that we would be handling that particular segment, but some subcommittee you know, should be looking, and the co-chairs, I'm sure, would be looking at you know, identifying whether or not the variables are correct there for the stars to line up in that direction.
Thank you.
Sorry for the digression. Please.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. The second half of this page is our policy package for our IT policy I've discussed. I'm happy to talk further about that if you have questions. I don't have a lot of answers, however. And the next section is quality efficiency improvements. One of the things that the board is going to complete in the 0507 biennium, which is going to be very much an efficiency measure and a quality enhancement, is the modification to our database to allow our enforcement information to be included on the database. That will allow many things. As Ms. Klimowitz already told you, it's going to make our work in the office much easier, because we used to have about 20,000 Excel spreadsheets carrying enforcement information in different manners and often very redundantly. If it's all in the database, then we're going to be able to pull down the reports we need through the mechanism of the database. It was partially for this that we upgraded our database to the highest software, and also in anticipation of being used for online licensing as well. The other important outcome of having enforcement information on the database is that we will be able to include it on our licensee search information for the public. Right now, if someone wants to know if a person is licensed with the Oregon Board of Accountancy, they may go on our website, put in the name, and they'll find out the person's whether the person is licensed, how long they've been licensed, and their current status. But that's all they'll find out. And if they have any questions about enforcement activities, they need to call the office, and we'll provide that information to them via the telephone. Now that we have the enforcement information available on the database, or we will have at the end of 07, we will be able to include synopsis of enforcement information on that licensee search, so that if you're looking to find out about a certified public accountant, you can also see whether there have been complaints against them and what have been the outcome of those complaints. We think that's going to be a significant help to our public and to our staff. Other things that the board does routinely and continuously are convening various committee meetings and task forces by telephone conference. This has become a real savings for our board and for those folks who like to participate in various committees and task forces that we have. It allows people who are in Pendleton and Baker City or Klamath Falls to serve on our committees without having to incur the time and the loss of travel coming to Salem to meet. At the same time, those people who are in Portland or Salem who would prefer to appear at the meeting in person may do so, but we have a telephone line available for anyone outside of the state. It's been a very useful function, and we've been using it more and more over the last 4 years. I'd say significantly more in the last 2 years. We also continue to increase our use of technology in updating our website, including on it information that is important both for licensees and for the public, increasing the number of downloadable forms that are available, increasing the number of things that you can do on the website and then send it to us by way of email. And finally, our enforcement program. I've already spoken to the efficiencies that we maintain in our enforcement program, and that is the things that we do on staff in the board office to reduce AG costs. We prepare all of the legal documents. We use consent orders as often as possible, and we schedule board meetings so that all of the things having to do with enforcement or complaints are together. That also allows people who want to come and respond to board members' questions or attend the hearing, the meeting, because they want to know the outcome of a particular action that's taken. That's all scheduled in the first part of the hearing, and folks can come for the meeting at that time. I have nothing further. If you have questions, I'd be happy to respond.
Questions?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Backing up, I may have missed it, to policy package 101. The request is for $50,000 to be funded by an appropriation from the board's cash reserves. I'm not familiar with the board's cash reserves and what those are held for and the amount and the process here. So could you speak to that a little bit?
Thank you. Chair Jensen? Representative Edwards, I'm happy to. For those members who have been on the committee in the past, they know that the board's cash reserves have been of an important discussion. We have a reasonable, if not healthy, ending balance. Our low ending balance occurs in April or May of the second fiscal year, and the average over the last 5 years ending balance of our low ending balance at that time has been between $450,000 and $475,000. Throughout the year, our ending balance may be as high as $1 million if we are in a period where we're receiving renewal income and our expenditures don't match our income. Then a couple of months later, the table flips and our expenditures are higher than our income. For example, January and February and March of this year, our revenue has been like $10,000 a month, which is a very small amount. Right now, our ending balance for December, at the end of December, was $962,000. Under the 05-07 budget estimates, I think the estimated ending balance is like $880,000. That may be high. In any event, we have sufficient funds there for the IT project, certainly. But the reason that the board prefers to maintain that ending balance is to allow us to have funds available when we have a complex investigation that's going to require outside consultants and the cost of which cannot be anticipated. So in that event, we will ask for an appropriation from our ending balance to cover the cost of those investigations.
Thank you.
Other questions?
I'm just curious about something. Going back to the complaints and the percent of complaints process, and by the way, on your key performance measures, I was able to sort of get the answer to the so what question. I'll throw that in. But under KPM2 on page 4 of 11, it states that the performance measure is established as standard time frame 6 months from the date a complaint is received until the investigation is referred to the complaints committee for consideration and recommendation to the board. I'm just curious as to why it has to take 180 days, and I know there was some discussion earlier around this notion that the faster the investigator goes, the behinder they get. But I'm, in terms of the decision to refer it to the complaint committee or not, so is that kind of like a pre-investigation or an investigation of whether or not to investigate? And what all does that entail? I mean, you get a complaint from a person about, you know, XYZ firm or Joe Blow CPA. what kind of information has to be gathered that makes that so time-consuming?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, thank you. We do not do a probable cause determination whether or not to investigate. The investigation that is passed to the Complaints Committee is deemed to be a full and complete investigation. If, in fact, the committee finds that something was missing, they certainly can throw it back and say, here's an aspect of this that you should have looked at or we'd like more information about. So it may not be a complete investigation, but that is not because it wasn't intended to be. The initial step is that the licensee is notified. They receive a copy of the complaint, and they have a 21-day period in which they must respond and provide information to the board about that complaint, their defense, so to speak. Then the board investigator obtains information from the person who submitted the complaint. All of this requires a lot of time. Most of the licensees will respond within the 21-day period, but many times they respond with a not now but later. I'm responding to you, so I'm not in violation of this rule, but I just can't gather this right now. May I have an extension of time? And so much of the information gathering is delayed simply because of the cooperation or lack thereof of folks who have that information in their hands and are not able or not willing to provide it as soon as possible. That complaint then is set aside until information starts coming in, and investigation won't begin until the information comes in. And as information comes in, it becomes apparent more information may be needed. We may need to have actual copies of the work papers. Copies of the work papers for an audit can be one or two boxes of documents. A licensee very legitimately will ask for additional time to have those copied and provided to us, and reviewing those kind of documents is a very lengthy process. It depends, Representative Crummell, on the complexity of the complaint, how much time it will take. Our investigator tries to modify the agenda that she prepares for the Complaints Committee by bringing some, you know, that are a little lighter. They're going to be easier for them to make a decision. We can get through six or seven complaints if we've got three or four that don't involve a serious allegation, and two or three more complicated complaints. We also will bring to the Complaint Committee complaints that the investigation would believe are going to be a no violation finding, because we would like to have that confirmed by the Complaints Committee and by the board, because it's the board who makes the final decision whether there's a violation or not a violation. So the six-month process, if you could work steadily, if things came in that you could work one through, 6 months would certainly be adequate for many complaints and inadequate for others. But the problem is you've always got this process of different ones in different stages.
Yeah, I think we agree.
Okay.
Okay. No further questions?
We're adjourned.